Hello, it's Andy Johnson from The Fried Egg. I want to thank everybody for tuning into our podcast. Because of Tom's gracious amount of time he gave us, we're going to split this podcast into two parts. We will be publishing part two on Friday. So please, you know, if you enjoy our podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps us out and it's greatly appreciated. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast with Tom.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I'm excited to welcome Tom Doak onto the podcast. Tom is one of today's preeminent golf course architects, as well as an esteemed author of books such as The Anatomy of a Golf Course, The Life and Work of Alistair McKenzie, and of course, his ultra-popular Confidential Guides to Golf Courses. Welcome on, Tom.
Thank you, Andy. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk golf course architecture today. And I think a great way to start would be to give the listeners a little bit about your background and how you got into golf course architecture.
Well, I certainly told this story a lot, so I'm probably covering ground a lot of your listeners have heard. But basically, I grew up playing a little public course a mile from my house in Stamford, Connecticut. But as a contrast to that, I saw some of the best golf courses in America when I was a kid. And my dad barely played golf, but he would go once or twice a year on some corporate thing where he played golf with the people he did business with on the phone all year. And they went to the best golf resorts in America. So Harbortown was one of the very first courses I ever saw when it was brand new and rated in Golf Digest top 10, and then Pinehurst not long after that, and then Pebble Beach not long after that, and then unfortunately one of the organizations that he was part of, they did their convention at Pebble Beach and they decided they really liked it, so they went back there like every other year when I was a teenager. So I played Pebble Beach a bunch, you know, long enough ago that the twilight rate was $40.
Things have changed a little bit since that day, huh?
Yes, they have. And I haven't played it very much since they went up to their current price.
Yeah, that's so would you say, you know, a lot of people say they have a singular moment or a golf course that, you know, inspires them to get even into, you know, becoming a fan of golf course architecture. Was there a singular moment or was it more of a building over your childhood years?
I guess it was more of a building. I mean, the two different things that I always go back to are when I was at Harbortown, and, you know, it was literally the third golf course I ever saw. There was the old golf writer Charles Price had a place at Hilton Head, and when Mr. Dye was building the golf course, he spent a lot of time with him. And then when the golf course opened, Mr. Price did a little booklet on the golf course, which is pretty much like a yardage book now, except no yardages because nobody played by yardages in 1970. But, you know, so there was a diagram of the hole and like three sentences on how to play. Like, second hole, you know, there's only one fairway bunker on the left, but you really need to be close to the fairway bunker on the left if you're trying for the green in two, because there's a tree up there on the right that you have to get past. You know, it was just a really simple primer on golf course architecture. Really well explained, simple enough a 10-year-old could go, oh, that's cool. So, you know, that's the first thing that got me interested in architecture, that there was much more to it than just hit the ball, find it, hit it again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, seeing Pebble Beach and Cypress Point when I was a kid was huge. You know, I mean, I always feel really lucky to have gotten to go to Cypress Point really early on. My dad's boss at Unilever, when he retired, moved out there and became a member of Cypress Point. So I got to play it two or three times when I was a teenager. And, you know, it's a very emotional place. And, you know, that's probably the place where I thought, you know, that there, that this was a great career and it would be a great thing to do if I could figure out how to do it. Although, you know, when I started at college, I didn't really know how to pursue it. And I had to, you know, I really had to write letters to everybody in the golf business to ask, you know, what I should do and how to go about it.
Mm-hmm. So after college, I know you worked under Pete Dye for a number of years. Did he give you the kind of first job right out of college, or was there somebody else in between that?
No, I didn't work for anybody else. The first job I had was working for Mr. Dye on a construction crew at Long Cove when I was 20. But I've been writing him letters for 3 years at that point. And I started on my 18th birthday. I was a freshman at college thinking, you know, engineering is not for me. I'm spending all my time reading golf books. I really should see if I could pursue this. And Pete Dye was one of the first people I wrote to. I wrote to Pete Dye and Jeff Cornish and Dean Beeman and Ben Crenshaw and a ton of people just asking for help. And, Pete got back to me when I was 18, just a nice little note back. And, you know, he didn't really offer much advice at that point. I got it from other people, but everybody else in the golf business said, you know, that's the guy you should work for. You know, if you can figure out how to get a construction crew working for him, that would be great. So I just kept writing him letters for 3 years until finally, when I was a junior in college, he called me like the day I was going on summer break and said, yeah, we kind of are losing some guys on our crew down here, and, you know, we could use a couple more people. Could you be here tomorrow? That was literally the first time I talked to him, and I was working for him the next day.
What a cool story. So with Mr. Dye, you know, who were some other influential people early in your career outside of Mr. Dye that you would say that really helped shape your kind of philosophies and your career?
Oh, God, there's lots. George Pepper, who is the editor of Golf Magazine, the one who gave me a chance to start writing about golf. I wrote him a letter to the editor when I was like 18 or 19, 18, because I remember it was actually about the top 50 golf courses list that they had just published, and a long critique of it. And he got back to me and said, well, you know, we're not putting an 18-year-old in charge of this, but you can really write. And, you know, we could use somebody who could write some stuff about architecture. So, you know, do you want to try to write like a little piece as a sidebar to the U.S. Open piece next year? So, you know, I started writing when I was a sophomore in college. And by the time when I was a senior, I had a writing for magazines course. And just before the semester was over, I had an 8-page feature article in Golf Magazine. So I did well in that course. But that was a huge help to me because of that, I didn't just have access to people as a young guy who wanted to be a golf course architect. You know, I could call up people in the golf business as a golf writer and ask them all sorts of questions. So that was great for me for access to people. And then, you know, Ben Crenshaw's been, you know, I wrote him a letter when I was 18 and said, if you were me, what would you do? And because even though he hadn't started in architecture yet, it was pretty well known that he was interested in architecture and tried to see great courses. So, you know, at first he listed a few courses that he thought I should see. And then he basically said, well, you know, if you come out to a tournament during a practice day, just come up and introduce yourself on a practice day, and, you know, we can walk around and talk about the golf course a little bit. So I did that 4 or 5 times while I was in college, and, you know, I got to walk inside the ropes with Crenshaw and Seve Ballesteros or David Graham and watch them play golf really up close, and then talk some about the golf course that we were seeing, and, you know, wouldn't trade those experiences for anything.
How, you know, you've had, you obviously Stonewall had the U.S. Mid-Am, and, you know, Bandon Dune, Pacific Dunes has had some amateur events and high level amateur events. And then you've obviously walked inside the ropes, like you just said, with, Crenshaw and, Seve Ballesteros. How much does it help, when you get to see that high level golf with architecture and kind of, you know, understanding principles and how different people play the game?
Well, it's a good question, and it's kind of, there's a lot of ways it helps, and there's some ways it hurts, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, because I worked for Mr. Dye, I was around the tour a lot when I was really young. You know, I worked for him just when the TPC at Sawgrass came out and they played. I was there for the first two tournaments. I spent a lot of time walking with Pete Dye those first 2 years of the tournament while he was, you know, while people were criticizing the golf course, and he was just walking around watching play, trying to decide for himself if the holes worked the way he thought they did. And they really did. You know, he'd gotten under the skin of the players a lot, and, you know, the guys that were more interested in architecture and more critical of the golf course were so tied up in that they couldn't play the golf course worth a damn. But then there were young guys that, you know, were just sort of, okay, you know, this is really tough and I got to hit these shots. And there were guys that could play the golf course. So, you know, that was a fascinating time to be around the tour and talk to some of those guys and see what their opinions were. You know, when I got on my own, I realized really fast that, you know, when I built High Point in Traverse City for a guy that had owned the land for years, you know, the tour was never coming there. You know, I mean, I was around the tour enough to understand that, you know, where they play tournaments at that level is about where the sponsors want them to. So, I never really visualized that my career would be about that at all. Certainly at the start, it wasn't going to be. So, you know, I kind of had to forget some of what I'd learned and not worry about building a set of tees at 7,400 yards, because the people that were paying $45 to play High Point didn't need those tees.
Yep.
And because I'd been around the tour a little bit, when early clients would bring up something like that, I could just laugh at them and correct them really fast. Like, no, don't think about that. You're crazy to think about that, unless you got $5 million burning a hole in your pocket, in which case, let's revise my design fee a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, you were part of the group of architectures that ushered in this, you know, new style of design that was minimalist and really, like you said, focused more on the everyday player and, you know, what they needed rather than building long, hard golf courses that kind of fit into a square box, par 72, 4 par 5s, 4 par 3s. What was, you know, the toughest part about, you know, kind of ushering in this new thought and new thinking of design?
Well, it wasn't, I mean, when I started High Point, you know, I really only had to answer to one client. And I sort of started with the idea that it was a really good piece of land, and if I failed, I wanted to fail on the side of, you know, moving less dirt instead of moving too much. Because everything I'd seen for the last 10 years was people moving too much for my case, you know. I mean, I by then I'd gotten around and seen most of the best golf courses in the world, And most of the ones I really liked weren't built that way. You know, I mean, I saw how Pete Dye built what he built, and I'm not demeaning it, but I mean, he's a genius for coming up with some of the things he did on bad pieces of ground. But when you got a good piece of ground, you don't have to do those things. And, you know, I was really lucky to stumble into my first job with a pretty good piece of ground to work with. And I just thought, you know, sort of the guiding light of it was that 3 miles down the road from High Point was a Jack Nicklaus course called the Bear at Grand Traverse Resort. And it was a completely manufactured golf course. They went out in a field and built a bunch of mounds and lakes and everything else and called it Scottish style, which just, you know, horrified me. But, you know, I just kept thinking, well, you know, I want to do something that's almost the dead opposite of that on this piece of ground and just see how it goes. And, you know, the superintendent that we hired to work on it, Tom Mead, who had been at Crystal Downs for a while before he worked with me, you know, he and I were talking about, at that point, you know, we were young and sort of like, well, if 50% of people like it and 50% of people hate it, then we'll be about the right place. And, of course, we didn't tell our client that because the client probably would have been horrified. You know, most clients want 99.9% of people to like it. They don't want to give up a potential customer. You know, and unfortunately, that's why everything gets so homogenized. Yeah. Oh, we better do 4 par 3s because that's what people like. And, you know, the old golf course architects didn't think that way. It hadn't been so standardized yet. And plus, they, you know, it wasn't such a commercial business in the 1920s. I mean, golf clubs in the 1920s were actually formed by a group of guys that wanted to build a golf club. Now they're formed by a developer who wants to sell memberships in it. Mm-hmm. You know, even if he's not really looking to make money in it, he's still concerned about, you know, he's taking the financial risk and he's got to figure out how to sell the memberships in it to get his money back. So, you know, he doesn't want to rock the boat too much. And that's, you know, a lot of architects are really afraid to rock the boat. And I'm just not, because I've seen a lot of things that are really different, and I know they worked, and I think, well, why can't I make that same idea work, or why can't I make a little different idea work?
It's interesting you talk about that, and I'm curious. You know, obviously, with Cypress Point, I know Alistair McKenzie was worried that he had gone too far and, you know, done too much, and worried that it was going to be too tough. But the natural beauty, obviously. Nobody complained about it. Do you feel that your golf course, when you build something and looking at it, you know, for the future of golf, you know, 20 years, do you feel like you need to have criticism from some angle if it's a great project? Does it have to have some sort of criticism?
Oh, I don't know. I just, you know, it doesn't have to. But I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's having been around Pete Dye for that week at Sawgrass, I'm not afraid of that because it'll never get more intense than that. Mm-hmm. and ultimately that was good for golf.
Yep. Yep. It's he did a great stuff. I think that Pete Dye often gets a very bad rap. You know, when people talk about his designs being too penal, and you having a front row seat to that, I imagine a lot of the design philosophy, some of his designs were based off of what the developer wants, correct?
Well, they always are, yes. You've always got to answer to your clients to some degree. And you know, and a lot of people, you know, when people criticize what other architects are doing, you know, that you have to stop and think, well, what are they being hired to do? You know, I mean, most of the projects that Jack Nicklaus gets, you know, the developer wants a big, expensive, quote-unquote championship golf course because he's trying to sell big, expensive lots next to it, and that's what those people think is prestige and what they want to live on. So, you know, if you're not going to see Jack Nicklaus build a 6,300-yard minimalist efficient golf course, because that's not the kind of people that hire him. You know, a lot of people are very critical of Mr. Dye, which to me is crazy. I mean, nobody that's ever spent any time with Pete Dye would criticize the man at all. I mean, he's given a lot to a lot of people. He's always been very open about the game and what he thinks is right about it and what he thinks is wrong about it. You know, he had me ghostwriting articles about how the golf equipment was getting out of hand 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. You know, he's still sort of a role model to me, especially in the way he went about the work, how involved he was in it personally, and that, you know, he made decisions out in the field and he changed his mind on the fly to make something better. He wasn't afraid to, you know, do that. And, you know, even if the client was nervous about it, you know, he's like, it's going to be fine. I'm here. I'll get it sorted out. And, you know, people see our work as being completely different because my golf courses don't look like his golf courses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way that they're built and, you know, and even a lot of the philosophy behind them. I mean, I'm building golf courses that are challenging to people. And, you know, I just put the challenge in different places and I don't make it all about length because I'm not building golf courses for the tour.
Yep. I think that the tour needs more golf courses where the challenge isn't, you know, off the tee, you know, you've got hazards on both sides and then hit it to the green, because it produces a certain type of player. You know, a golf course.
There's no doubt that the tour courses and the way they set up the courses favor certain kinds of players. Yeah. And, you know, they're not doing it deliberately, but they do make deliberate decisions that have that effect. You know, like they'll set up a hole so the long hitters can make a carry and the short hitters really can't. Mm-hmm. You know, and they think that rewards the guy who can hit the ball farther. But then if the wind's in the face of that hole and the long hitters can't make the carry, they'll move the tees up so that the long hitter can still make the carry and the short hitter still can't. So now who are they? You know, now it's clear they have a bias.
I think,
you know, any short hitter on tour will tell you that.
I think a perfect example of that is you look at Riviera and, you know, probably the best architecturally sound golf course that they play year in, year out. And, you know, they haven't had a winner at Riviera younger than 28 years old in the last, I think, 12 years. And it favors somebody that understand. I think that course has no forced carries. It's more about hitting shots to the correct angles than it is hitting it far. You know, there is a lot of strategy if you go for a carry and you don't. You know, there's so much that goes into that golf course, and I really think that's a great example. You see guys like last year, you had KJ Choi, you know, in the lead late on Sunday, and this guy is a 45-year-old who hits it, you know, 270 yards. And this year you have Dustin Johnson win it, albeit it was soft and, you know, the rain took a lot of the teeth out of it, but, you know, that's a course where it doesn't really favor a specific type of player.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it doesn't favor a specific type of player. It does reward a player who knows how to work the ball left to right and right to left, which you don't. There's not many courses on tour that do anymore. Yeah. It's really hard to build that on a new course with no, you know, if you don't have any trees, you know, and you can, you know, and you can carry the ball as far as those guys do, you know, even if the fairway is curving left to right or right to left or the bunkers are set up a certain way, you know, they can just hit it a mile in the air and land it 300 yards away in a relatively small area.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter which way it's curving.
So,
but, you know, Riviera takes that away. There's holes that you can't hit that, you know, if you're on 15, which kind of bends left to right off the tee, and you can't hit that shot, you kind of have to back off on the tee shot. Because if you just, you know, because you can't take it up over the trees on the right to go down there where you want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain shots that it takes away from you on certain holes, and so you have to be able to adapt. You know, Dustin Johnson can adapt. You know, even if he's not going to try to hit the ball left to right, he'll back off, and he's still long enough. He can hit the long shot into the green for the second shot.
So I had Michael Clayton on the podcast a couple months ago, and he talked about how he believes technology has diminished the skill, and obviously, you know, nobody's going to argue it's altered the path or the design. You know, you designed your first course in 1989. How have your philosophies changed over the years because of technology?
My philosophy hasn't changed very much in 30 years, you know. And some people would say, oh, you shouldn't say stuff like that. That doesn't sound right. But, you know, again, I'm not building my courses for the elite players. I mean, I think about the elite players. I've been around enough of them. You know, Mike Clayton, I've had more fun playing golf with Mike Clayton a half a dozen times than with almost anybody I've ever played with, because he, you know, he does know how to work the ball and have shots. You know, he came to the States a bunch of years ago when I was doing that Arcapalooza thing, and we were going out to Sandhills. We stopped and played a couple of the other courses in the Sandhills on the way out, and one of them, that Bayside course that Dan Proctor and Dave Axland built, it's had some really severe holes, and there was a hole that was a little like Six at Riviera with a bunker in the middle of a green, except more slope around it. And the pin was like back right, and after we'd all hit a shot to the green, I was like, I wonder if you could hit a shot, you know, that green looks so severe, it's like you could land a ball on the upper tier behind the pin or behind the bunker and have it sucked back down around the bunker to the lower tier where the pin is. And, you know, it took Mike two tries to hit that shot. And you know, there's a lot of guys on tour that can hit those kind of shots. And the shots that Seve used to try to play, and the shots that Ben Crenshaw used to play all the time, but there's no percentage in it anymore. You know, nobody builds a golf course where, I mean, you know, that wasn't that wasn't really the high percentage shot for Mike at the time. It was just like, yeah, I could pull that off. And it's a shame we don't see courses that get them to try those shots, because they're really, you know, that's what I learned from Pete Dye watching the TPC. Those guys are way more talented than you get to see week to week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that.
But for my own work, you know, my own work will give them chances to hit shots like that. But I'm just not worried about whether they're going to shoot 64 when they come, because I don't have, you know, because there's not going to be a 72-hole PGA Tour stroke play event on this course. And I don't have any ego at stake over what they do. You know, Gary Woodland went to Dismal River a couple of years ago thinking he should play on Fescue the week before he went to Chambers Bay for the Open, and shot 59 one day on my course. and you know, that kind of boggles my mind. And at the same time, I'm like, yeah, you know, he's that good. If he gets it going, you know, those aren't the most severe greens I ever built. He's reaching the par fives in two, no problem. Yeah, and probably driving one of the par fours too. So, yeah, he could shoot a number like that if he plays a great round of golf. And that doesn't really bother me, you know. And the thing is, I think if you asked him, he'd say, oh, no, that was a great round, and I had a lot of fun, and it's not like I wasn't challenged.
Yeah.
It's just that, the number adds up to what it adds up to. But,
it's, well, you know, I think that's a huge problem with golf is this – Why are we so wrapped up with par? It's just a number. Like, who cares if you go out and shoot 63 or 83 as long as you had fun, you know?
Right. And, you know, you could go different directions with that. Like, you know, I went and saw David Kidd's course at Gamble Sands a couple of years ago. And I had heard about it, that you know, kind of as a reaction to some of the other things that he'd done that were critiqued pretty heavily, including by me, that, you know, he'd built a golf course that was, you know, it was big and pretty, but it was pretty easy. You know, like, I mean, in Golf Club Atlas, the first testimonial to it, like, five of the eight guys in my group had their career low score. And I'm like, well, that sounds crazy. You know, if it's really that easy that, you know, everybody's shooting their career low score, then, you know, because I work for Pete Dye. I still believe that you want to challenge the golfer. I don't believe that you want to make them shoot 112, but you want some shots out there that are challenging to them. And if you're doing that, then they're probably not shooting their career low score the first time they see the place.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a fine, you know, there's a fine line. I mean, one of the things I've learned about design is, you know, I think a lot of my best work is the par fours, and especially the short par fours. And the reason the short par fours come out so good is because you can get away with more. You know, it's like, it's only 350 yards, so this green can be severe, or that, you know, I can pinch the landing area really narrow, or I can put cross bunkers 40 yards in front of the green, because, you know, because I'm not making you lay up off the tee and hit a four wood in. Mm-hmm. You know, you can approach this a whole bunch of different ways. And the other thing that's interesting about short par fours is, you know, you can give people a really wide range of angles into the green. You know, on a 470 yard hole, most people, you know, they just have to hit it on the beeline because they have to hit it as far as they can twice just to get there. And they can't really worry about what kind of angle they're giving themselves. But a 350 yard hole, yeah, you can drive it way out to the right and still be hitting 9-iron or wedge.
Yeah, I from what I've played about seven of your courses, and you, the short par fours are really great. And they, what I really like about them is if you play them correctly, you've got a great shot at, you know, you should make birdie. But if you, the second you get out of position, you're in a very, very difficult place where all of a sudden you're looking at it and like, well, I have to hit a really great shot here to make, you know, have a chance at three and even make four sometimes, depending on how far out of position you get. Not to mention, you know, you have so many different ways you could play it. One that comes to mind is Stream Song. Is it 13 at Stream Song or 14?
Yep.
13.
13.
Uh-huh. And that one, I tried to hit driver and I got into the left bunker and oh my God, I was just in the worst place in the world. And I think I just picked up my ball after about seven shots.
Well, you know, that hole is kind of loosely based on, not so loosely based on, six at Pacific Dunes. It's the only hole at Stream Song that, We had to do a lot of earthwork on that hole. I mean, it was kind of, the fairway was a lot higher than it is now, and it was, you couldn't even see where the water was coming in on the left because the fairway was so high. You couldn't see over it and see that there was a really steep, and there was like a really steep, dangerous edge to the left side. So we kind of had to cut it down to make it where you could get people around the golf course without somebody driving a cart over a cliff by accident. And, you know, and you know, Bill Corr needed the dirt from that fairway for one of the tees that he wanted to build. So we just, you know, we just moved all the dirt over to his hole and, you know, just whittled away at the fairway until we got it down. But I was trying to think of, okay, how do I do a short par four with the fairway down and the green up? And, you know, I think six at Pacific is one of the best holes that I've built. So it's the only hole I've tried to copy that basic idea from for this hole as well. I mean, the difference is the one at Stream Song is even a little shorter, and you're usually not playing it right into the teeth of the wind. So you can't, you know, at Pacific, it's into the wind most of the time. So, you know, driving the green is not really, you know, you could drive it up near there somewhere, but if the wind is in your face, you're not going to drive the green unless mm-hmm. you're a tour pro.
Yeah.
Even the tour pros aren't going to do it that much. Stream Song, you can really take a shot at it if you want. I mean, it's a hell of a risk. I've never hit driver on that hole myself. I haven't played it a lot of times. But, you know, I'm not going to take the bait on that particular hole because I know how many things can go wrong. And
when...
a friend of mine says that on my short par fours, you should just never take the bait. That no matter how tempting it looks, this will be an easy birdie if I just do this. That's usually a bad play, at least for them, percentage-wise. And and that's kind of what you're trying to do. Yeah, I mean, you're at least trying to make it where the guy who is, going for something is taking a big risk to do it.
Well,
if you could drive it anywhere and still make birdie all the time, then that's not a very good hole.
I agree, and I mean, I walked off the hole and I thought to myself, why the hell did you just hit driver when you can just hit a 4-iron right here and you've got a wedge in? And I think that's a great way, though. That's a great subtle way to challenge, the better player, is to give them something that entices them to hit driver, because every really good player thinks they can hit driver where they want it if they really need to. And
yes, and they think that they should be entitled to hit driver on every single longer hole. Mm-hmm. I've heard that criticism a bunch from good players. Oh, don't take the driver out of my hands, and I don't.
Yeah.
I just make it like a stupid play sometimes that you can hit it. I'm not making you lay up. Just you better hit a good shot if you do it.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of golf. The tough part about doing that, though, and the reason you don't see every other architect doing the same thing, is because it's not always popular to do that. You walked off it thinking, oh, I've learned something about architecture, but a lot of, low handicap guys are going to make, they make 8 on a short par 4, they hate the hole, and they might hate the whole golf course as a result of that. And they're not going to go back and play it the second time and figure it out.
Yeah.
So and then the client is nervous about that. So there's a lot of, and the architect is nervous about that because he wants to win some award, and he doesn't want good players to go around telling him he's building unfair golf courses. It's really bad for business. So there's a lot of guys that just shy away from building things like that might be controversial. And again, I mean, I've just been, I've just been trained from day one not to be afraid of any of that, that actually makes the golf course better in the long run, provided you have the confidence that people are going to come back, and yeah, you have to have some confidence. And where I am now, it's a little easier to have that confidence. People will give me the benefit of the doubt, and but I only got there because I've been doing it from the start.
Yeah.
Even when I was risking my career, I was building those kinds of holes.
So which of your projects are you most proud of? It doesn't have to necessarily be the best one or the highest rated one, but what one are you most proud of and why?
Well, I don't give the politically correct answer that they're all my children. I'm proud of a lot of them. I mean, we've worked on some great projects, and not just me, but the guys that work for me have spent a ton of time on them trying to get them right, and I think they've come out really good. And, so picking one between Pacific Dunes and Barn Boogle and then some places like Rock Creek that aren't as well known, or Stone Eagle that was really hard to build, but it's not everybody's cup of tea. I'm proud of all of those. To some extent, I'm just as proud of something like Common Ground, that we built a public course that people can play for $40, especially considering some of the programs that they've come up with to not just encourage golf, encourage public golf and encourage youth golf there, but we managed to build them a little kids course on the side for free for, what we saved up during the construction budget by building it as efficiently as we could. And they've used it for all kinds of school programs. And then then one of the people involved with the Evans scholarships in Colorado decided to like start like a caddy camp and leadership academy on it, so that they train the kids, the local kids in the neighborhood, and kids that they bus in to be caddies, and they subsidize it. So they pay the caddy a little bit out of their funds, so that you only have to pay $25 to pick a caddy. It doesn't cost any more than a golf cart would. And then by letting these kids caddy, if they caddy more than like 20 rounds in a summer, they're eligible to apply for the Evans Scholarship.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I'm really proud of that for entirely, you know, for reasons that have nothing to do with golf course architecture or my ego. You know, mm-hmm. It's just nice to work for clients that try to do cool things for golf like that.
Yeah, I think that is an emerging trend in the industry. What we're starting to see is, you know, with places like Winter Park Golf Course and Common Ground, where there's these new, you know, municipality run golf courses that are less expensive. And, you know, one of the things I think is interesting is that, you know, everybody likes to go, they don't really know the names of architecture, and you've established a great intern program. I'd be curious, you know, if you were running a municipality and you could hire, you know, if you could put five guys on a list of who you'd want to hire to do a lower cost renovation of a golf course, who would they be?
You're asking me to pick between like 15 guys that have worked for me at various times and I've helped train that are all really talented, you know, including three guys, you know, including three or four that still work for me on my payroll who are as talented as any. I mean, you know, the hardest thing about my company is that, you know, I always envisioned that the guys would, you know, the young people that we brought in, you know, would want to move through and then try to get out on their own. You know, like I did when I worked for, you know, I worked for PTI for like 4 years. And there wasn't really a way to keep working for PTI. He didn't really keep a payroll. He just moved from one project to the next, and they were all over, and you just had to pick up and move to the next one when you were done with one. So it was a business model where the employees were intended to kind of burn out after a while, and then you'd find new people to replace them. You know, he gave a lot of people a chance that way, and I've tried to do the same thing. But you know, when the recession happened and all of a sudden it was really hard to get a job, then, you know, nobody wants to leave and try to go on their own. And that was, you know, that was a really tough thing in my company, having to downsize a little bit and try to figure out who stayed and who left. You know, and I tried to do it in a way, you know, I kind of kicked the senior guys out of the nest, which was very controversial, but yeah, I knew they could make it on their own by then, and I knew the other guys couldn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and by that point, you know, the younger guys were the ones that were on the machine shaping the stuff. And to me, that's the most important part of the whole deal. You know, if you're really good at that, you will always have work in this business. And, you know, and that's one of the great things about my internship program. All these young guys that have worked for me, if I don't have, you know, I mean, I don't want to be so busy, you know, I don't want to be gone 365 days a year so that they can all stay busy. You know, I can only do so many projects a year without losing my mind, you know, getting too frazzled trying to do too many things. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these guys, you know, especially with the, you know, with Eric Iverson and Brian Slonick and Brian Schneider, who still work for me, I mean, all the young guys that have worked for us know that it's going to be hard to ever, you know, get past them and root one of them out. I mean, they, you know, they're like still young and enthusiastic guys with like 15 years experience on the equipment who can, you know, build anything you want at the snap of a finger. So, you know, so all the young people that come through see the writing on the wall that they're either going to have to go on their own or they're going to have to go work for somebody else eventually, you know, when we're not so busy. But they are, you know, they're, you know, the cool thing is that nearly every good project in the last 15 years, no matter who the architect is, there's like one or two guys that worked for me for a while that have helped build it. And because we've had success and because a lot of architects are curious about how we do things, you know, having worked on Barnboogle Dunes or Pacific Dunes or Dismal River or wherever is a pretty good thing to have on your resume. And, you know, some other architect will want you to work on his project so he can try to get a little bit of that knowledge into it.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think you're on the right kind of philosophy. The best boss I ever had told me that, you know, part of being a boss is always trying to make, you know, the people that report to you end up being better at your job than you are.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and it's a weird thing because I mean, I'm a very hands-on person, and you know, I'm still kind of resistant to the fact that, you know, I've graduated to the point where I'm not as hands-on on my own projects. You know, I mean, I went out and walked what's left of High Point with somebody the other day and said to him, well, you know, the special thing about this is the only one of these courses that I built all these greens myself. And you know, I'm not saying they're better than the ones that my guys are doing with me now. We're turning out great work now, too. But, it was different. Because it was all me, and I really enjoyed that part of the business. And I'm a bulldozer to justify. I mean, I've clearly got tons of people around about when I did it at High Point, but that, you know, a lot of times I didn't even know exactly where I was going when I would get on and start building the green, but, you know, I knew when to jump off because it looked good. And that's a really different process than what everybody imagines we do, that we have an exact idea of what this green is going to look like, you know, when we're tromping around in the trees before we ever start building a golf course. I mean, I don't have that all figured out in my mind. You know, that's the fun part. That's what makes going to work every day exciting, is, you know, figuring it out and making it better as you go.
Yeah. So you've done a ton of restorations, of a lot of classic golf courses. What would you say is the most difficult thing about doing a restoration versus designing a course, and, you know, some of the key differences?
Oh, by far the most difficult thing is dealing with big committees or, you know, hundreds of members as your client instead of one guy. you know, because I've never worked for any club where everybody was really on the same page. There are all sorts of factions and differences of opinion as to, you know, what direction they should be going. And they're looking to you for advice, but there's always going to be people that disagree with you. And, you know, and that's, you know, I've been really lucky in the golf courses I've done by myself. You know, I haven't worked for, you know, I imagine that dealing with, you know, having a municipal project, you could run into that same problem. You know, you're dealing with a committee. I've built 35 new courses, and only once I dealt with a committee. Nearly always I had like one person that I answered to. And that's just, you know, that's great, because if you as long as they're okay with what you're doing, then you don't have to worry about what else you're doing. When you've got a bunch of members, then they want to know all the details in advance. You know, the one person client, he could be comfortable with the fact that you don't know everything right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other than that, I mean, you know, where I think a lot of restoration, renovation work goes wrong is, you know, not so much the ideas, but the execution. I mean, you know, in theory, if it's really a restoration project, then no matter what architect you hired, they should be telling you the same thing. I mean, here's what the golf course was, here's what we should be trying to go back. But there, you know, there's varying interpretations of what restoration means. You know, does it mean putting back exactly what was there in 1926? Or does it mean, well, technology changed and we all hit the ball so much farther now that, you know, we're going to make it play the same, but we got to stretch it out and move the fairway bunkers to different places and all that. You know, that's not the way I advise clubs most of the time, but you know, that's a different interpretation. So you do have different ideas on what restoration is, but ultimately when you're rebuilding something, you know, ideally you'd just be doing the work that really needs to happen. Like, you don't have to rebuild 100 fairway bunkers. You don't have to rebuild every bunker on this golf course. You just have to rebuild some. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but you can only do that if you're good enough to make the new ones look indistinguishable from the stuff that was built 50 years ago. And there's not that many people that are good at that. You know, when you do it the normal way and bid it out to a contractor, they're not good at that, and they don't have that much incentive at being good at that. They just, you know, their contract is to build a bunker and get it done as fast as they can and not have to tinker around with it so much, because they make more money that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we just, you know, I've got the guys who can get on the equipment and shape it and make it look like it fits. And, you know, and our incentive is all about getting it right, however long it takes. And, you know, that's what our clients want.
Yeah, it's so you've got the Loop opening this year, which is a reversible course. If anybody hasn't heard of it, you can play, it's essentially two different golf courses with 18 greens that you can play a different direction each day.
Right. It's an 18-hole golf course that every other day you play it backwards down the mm-hmm. 18 fairways in the 17th fairway and all the way back around. And then the next day you play it forwards again.
And then you also did the Sheep Ranch out in Bandon Dunes, where it's essentially you put the ball on the ground and you tee it to different greens. I love this concept. What are some other kind of innovative concepts that you've got that you would love to try out?
I've got a bunch. You know, not all of them are like groundbreaking innovation. And, you know, the reversible golf course wasn't my idea. I mean, yeah, that's something I read about in Tom Simpson's book when I was like 16 years old and just thought, God, that's a cool idea. I'd love to do something like that someday. Uh-huh. It just took me a long, long time to find the right place to do it. So some of the things that I'm thinking about, God, I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to do them, but there's a few different kinds of projects that I'd like to do. One that I'll put out there that I've tried to sell to one or two clients and they've shrugged it off and like, no, we don't want to do anything like that. I would like to build a golf course that's tailored to women. You know, not just like has a good set of women's tees, but it's 6,300 yards max, because that's the longest the LPGA player would want to play it, and it goes down from there. You know, that would be an entirely different experience. You know, I spent a couple of days in the practice rounds of the Women's Open at Sabonic, watching them play my course, and you know, like up close, I contacted Stacey Lewis and Paula Creamer in advance of that event and said, you know, could I walk with you for a round and just, you know, watch what you're doing, and in return I'll answer any questions you have about how I think you ought to play certain holes. And they both said, yes, we'll do that. Mm-hmm. So that was great for me to get back inside the ropes and you know, see where they land the ball and see how it reacts. And, you know, they're so precise. I mean, and women golf, you know, like in Savannah, the percentage of fairways hit statistic was like, you know, the last player in the field was at 70%. The best players are at like 96 because the fairways are wide and, you know, they just stripe it like they're used to playing every golf course like it's 20 yards wide. They never miss wide very much.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a chance to, you know, and they don't hit the ball quite so high as the men do.
Yep.
So, you know, designing a course, thinking about their skill set would be very different. It wouldn't have to be this big, wide thing that everybody builds now that I sort of helped popularize. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, we've gone too far in that direction because all you see now is, you know, every course that's won the Best New Award for the last 20 years is like the biggest, widest golf course that was up for nomination that year. It's like bigger is better.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true. And I think the way to do it is, you know, like, really, I just want to build a 6,200-yard golf course. But I think that the way to sell just only building a 6,200-yard golf course is to say, okay, this is a great course for women, and you guys can try your luck on it, but you're going to find out, it's not a pushover.
It could be
even though it's short.
Women and juniors, you need the LPGA Tour to create a TPC Sawgrass-like course for one of their championships.
Well, supposedly they did years ago, whatever the LPGA International is that Reese Jones designed. I've never seen it. But I don't think it's the course that I'm describing here.
Probably not.
I sure haven't heard a lot about it.
So you touched on Savannah, and you've done a couple co-design projects with other firms. You know, how tough is it to kind of share a vision with another ego on a project?
It's tough, and it's different depending on who it is. Like, you know, yeah, if I mean, the two projects that I did in Australia, we worked with Mike Clayton's firm. And that was pretty easy because I was friendly with Mike going into it, and by the same token, I had more experience than he did at that point, so he really deferred to me on a lot of stuff. You know, it was more like he was a consultant, but at the same time, you know, the one of the reasons we entered into that agreement was, you know, he had some really strong guys that worked for him that would help get the golf course built, project manage it. You know, one of them was a superintendent for years and had been an assistant at Royal Melbourne, who I really respected a lot. And I was like, you know, so, you know, he had some team members, like I had some team members that really fit well together. So that made it easy. But at the end of the day, you know, it was like, you know, he'd give a lot of input, but ultimately it was my decision on what way to go. You know, Savannah was completely different. You know, we had to agree from the beginning that, you know, nothing was finished until we both liked it. And, you know, that meant that Jack, you know, there were some holes that, you know, we tried to do some stuff that Jack didn't like, so we'd have to keep revising them, which is hard. And there were some holes that he wanted to do that, you know, I didn't like it exactly the way it was, and he's not used to hearing that from somebody else. But, you know, the relationship between me and Jack was still pretty good because that's what we agreed to do. And we both understood going in that that's what we were agreeing to. But the hard part was getting our teams to mesh didn't work very well. I mean, on that project, you know, Jim Urbina, who ran the job with me, and then Brian Schneider and Eric and some of the guys that shaped it, they had to take like several steps back from the role that they're usually involved and the level they're usually involved. You know, like, I mean, the cool thing for Eric or Brian working for me is if they build a wild green and I like it, it's done. And at Savannah, it wasn't done. You know, I could like it, and then Jack didn't like it, and then it had to change, and that was hard for them. That's, you know, that's not what they were used to. And the odds that they were going to build a green that flew through with flying colors and we were done were a lot lower. So, you know, that part of it was really tough. And there were just, you know, there were more politics to that job than most. Again, you know, that's what we signed up for. And, you know, and I always said about that project, well, you know, other people are going to have to tell me if they think this was a good idea to get us together to design it, because, you know, both Jack and I are always going to look at it like, oh, I would have done something different on that hole. You know, and yet it's a pretty good golf course, and it posted some big things and gotten a lot of acclaim for doing it. So I'm not saying that they did it the wrong way. You know, it's a different kind of emotional experience to doing it. And, you know, I don't get to go back to some of my own courses and enjoy them and play them as often as I'd like. But when I do go back to them, I really feel good about most of them. You know, it's not like I'm tinkering and second guessing myself and, you know, wanting to go rebuild the third green because I just don't like the way it turned out. And, you know, so in most cases, I can just go back and play golf and have fun. And I actually play pretty well because I, you know, because I'm comfortable with all the shots that I got to hit. You know, Sabonic is kind of the rare one that when I go back, there's still questions about it. And, you know, even if I'm playing with a friend, they all want to know, like, okay, so is this your idea or is this Jack's idea? And it just takes away from the fun we normally have building the thing.
Mm-hmm. It's, I imagine it's just got to be so tough when both have to sign off on it, and, you know, it kind of differing design philosophies with the two firms.
I mean, partly it's, you know, I will say too, partly it's my fault. I mean, if I had known Jack Nicklaus well at the beginning of the thing, I should have said to him, you know, look, don't worry that we're going to ignore what you have to say. You know, you don't have to babysit us to make sure that we're sticking to things.
Yeah.
You know, just let us rough in stuff for you and then come out and you know, tell us all the changes you want to make just like you would to your own staff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that course was overstaffed.
Yeah.
We didn't need all my people and all his people there at the same time. That part was the part that didn't work so well.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. So